You are here today for a terrific presentation by our own Catherine Corneal, who is the Newton College Alumni Chair of Western Culture. She's a professor of comparative theology and chair of the theology department here at Boston College. Her research interests include the theology of religions and concrete questions in the Hindu-Christian and Buddhist-Christian dialogues. She's the author of The Impossibility of Interreligious Dialogue. She's the founding and managing editor of the book series Christian Commentaries on Non-Christian Sacred Texts and the editor of the Wiley Blackwell Companion to Interreligious Dialogue. And for 5 years here at BC, she organized and hosted the BC Symposia on Interreligious Dialogue, which brought scholars from different religions from all over the world together to focus on fundamental questions in interreligious dialogue. The final of the five books that came out of that, and I'll pass this around, is called Women and Interreligious Dialogue. She'll be talking a bit about that today. Her academic credentials include a licentiate in theology, a BA in philosophy, and PhD in religious studies from the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, and an MA in Asian religions from the University of Hawaii, which we're all jealous to have missed as well. So please join me in welcoming Professor Catherine Corneal.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you all for coming. I'm honored that you've taken time from your schedules to be here. I did bring some flyers with the titles of the conferences and the volumes that have appeared in this series of interreligious dialogue, so if you want to just pass that out. So my area of expertise is, in fact, not necessarily the questions of women in interreligious dialogue. So my own research is mostly on methodological issues in comparative theology and interreligious dialogue. But I work on very boring topics like, you know, the problem of choice in interreligious dialogue, conditions for interreligious dialogue, the confessional nature of interreligious dialogue. And I thought that, you know, that would be a little bit boring for you to listen to. So I thought the problem of women or the question of women in interreligious dialogue would be more interesting for a conversation here. Also, I thought it would be nice to share a little bit of what has been happening here at Boston College with all these conferences on interreligious dialogue that took place in the course of 5 years, and to you know, give you some taste of some of the insights that came out of these conferences. And I will, in a little while, put some quotes up on PowerPoint so that we can have something to talk about or to discuss maybe quotes that came out of the volume on interreligious dialogue, women in interreligious dialogue. So first, in the general area of interreligious dialogue or comparative theology, what we see is that in order for real dialogue to be possible, religions have to find some area of commonality or similarity or some bridge to cross over to the other and then look into more of the differences between religious traditions. And the experience of women in different religious traditions is one of the obvious similarities, I think, across religious traditions. Nevertheless, what we see is that women have been notoriously absent, indeed, from high-level dialogues. If you see sort of representatives from different religious traditions coming together for high-level discussions, you will almost never see a woman on that, on those panels. You know, academic dialogues between scholars from different religious traditions also have, you know, here and there a woman present, but not in the, in any majority. And I realized that myself, if you look at the other volumes in the series, you know, there are one or two women who contributed to the other volumes, but by no means, you know, a majority. So I wanted to sort of think about this a little bit more systematically and programmatically and bring women together from different religions to look at what can be done or how or what it is that women might contribute to interreligious dialogue that might be distinctive or not. You know, so those were some of the questions raised. But if we think just of, you know, what potentially women can learn from each other or how they can come together to share common experiences, you know, there are so many fundamental areas. If you look at, you know, the main world religions, insofar as they are all textual traditions, what we see is that throughout history, the authority over the interpretation of texts has always been monopolized by men. You know, so women, even understanding of women's position in traditions was always dependent on its elucidation and interpretation by men in the tradition. So if you look at all the major world religions, women have never been in a position where they were able to gather knowledge and interpret their respective traditions. Yeah, so that's one commonality that women have. In the process of interpreting the traditions, then, another commonality is a kind of preoccupation in different world religions with women's sexuality. You know, from female circumcision through the wearing of the veil or to the persecution of witches in Christianity, there's something that every religious tradition has as a stain at some point in its history, and that is this kind of preoccupation, sometimes even obsession, with the control of women's sexuality. And that's also another area of commonality that would be, or that is very interesting for women to exchange ideas about. A third area of commonality is that in spite of everything that I just said, that women have risen to positions of remarkable authority in areas of spirituality and mysticism. You know, from the Buddhist nuns before the Common Era, who had themselves developed their own scripture, the Theragatha, to, you know, the different monastic orders in Christianity, to the fact that Islamic mysticism, in fact, is attributed to a woman as the first mystic, Rabia, and so forth. So within the area of spirituality and mysticism, it's clear that women have been able to rise to positions of authority and to be recognized in their tradition. So both negatively and positively, there are numerous overlaps between religious traditions. So I think, you know, in all of these areas, women can come together and help each other reflect on their traditions from a critical perspective, you know, look at what the dynamics are of exclusion and marginalization of women. Because as long as we don't see this reality in a broader spectrum, it's easy to just accept the rationale that's given from within a particular religious tradition, that this is what God wants and this is what the scripture says. When you start seeing it in a broader context with a kind of dynamics that's returning in all religious traditions, you start suspecting that there's something else going on and that there is a kind of deep-seated patriarchy that is obvious in religious traditions and that should help women also free themselves from any kind of sense that this is something that God may have wanted or that that is given in human nature. So the critical reflection on the tradition, also critical reflection on certain types of oppression of women and so on that you might not see within your own tradition, all of those areas, I think, are areas of dialogue or potential dialogue between women. And then on the other hand, constructively, the way feminists in different religious traditions have developed a critical discourse of their tradition and also constructively developed, you know, new ways of thinking about their scriptures and their traditions in a more liberative way. You know, women can learn from each other across religious traditions about the ways in which this has been done. Okay, so that's sort of, I think, all quite obvious in terms of women and dialogue about women's issues. Now, what was remarkable in this meeting and in this volume is that we brought together women who thought actually a little bit beyond sort of the obvious ways in which women can learn from each other and reflected more critically about ways in which women from one tradition have often contributed to negative stereotypes of women in other religious traditions, and that it's not all roses and constructive dialogue between women, but that, you know, Western feminism has often been complicit in, you know, denigrating Islam as being necessarily misogynistic or patriarchal and so forth. And that has harmed women in Islam, because any association of Muslim women then with Western feminists is then seen as suspicious or suspect. in the Islamic tradition. So there are different ways in which, you know, the encounter between women of different religious traditions has actually been just as damaging as it has been constructive. And we see that, you know, many of the articles in this volume reflect on that. You know, there are some sort of stereotypes also that the volume breaks through. For example, the stereotype of Abraham is the father of all three monotheistic traditions. When we look at details about Abraham's relationships, it becomes a little bit more problematic how he treats, or how he and Sarah treat Hagar and so on. So all of the gender dynamics, you know, that are involved in us all referring to Abraham as our patriarch, that's also another area of critical reflection, I think, that is interesting to probe a little more deeply and to, you know, to acknowledge at least that it's not quite as simple as it's sometimes presented. And then a very interesting development. So in some feminist discourse, in particular in Islam, some Islamic feminists have attributed negative stereotypes of women in Islam to Christian and Jewish influence, to biblical influence. So Rifat Hassan is a very famous Muslim feminist, for example. She argues that the Quran is in fact has in fact much more gender equality than the Bible does. And in particular, in Surah 4, verse 1, the creation story in the Quran emphasizes the equality of men and women in the process of creation. Nevertheless, in the Hadith tradition, Islam has also appropriated the story of the crooked rib. And so Rifat Hassan, for example, accuses, you know, the biblical tradition of being guilty of having imposed that story on the Islamic tradition. So you can say Rifat Hassan is sort of a first generation Muslim feminist. Now the next generation has come, and Aisha Hidayatullah, for example, argues that, you know, that's not enough. That Muslim feminists have to go further and then think about, how come that Islam has been so receptive to the crooked rib? You know, can we just sort of completely exonerate the Quran from any sort of patriarchal or misogynistic tendencies, and do we have to blame Christianity, or is it also up to us, them, Muslim feminists, to take some responsibility and accountability for the fact that this has been possible and continues to be possible also in Islam? So I thought that was really an interesting sort of next step in Muslim-Christian or Muslim-Christian-Jewish dialogue of younger generation of Muslim feminists taking sort of accountability for those kinds of developments in the tradition. There's a sort of a continuing, of course, critique of Islamic feminists against the way the West keeps stereotyping Islamic women as being oppressed and excluded and marginalized and so on, and not allowing Muslim women themselves to speak in their own voice and argue for their own ideas of what an Islamic feminism would really look like. And that's a constant theme, actually, in contemporary interreligious women's dialogue, is that every tradition should have the freedom and the responsibility to develop its own distinctive form of feminism, using their own sources, their own symbols, their own ideas of what women's liberation would really be about. And also recognizing that within every religion there are radical differences between feminisms. Rosemary Ruther, for example, who's sort of the sort of mother of Christian theological feminism, was recognizing this and arguing that Western Christian feminists have to come to what she calls a transnational feminism, where we don't go to other context and tell them what feminism should look like, but we enter into a dialogue where we still can maybe offer something. I mean, sometimes in post-colonial discourses we've become so shy that nobody dares to say anything that might be helpful to the other anymore. And I think, you know, there's also some recognition that women really can sort of shed a new light on the other from outside, but, you know, without imposing a particular discourse on the other. I think that's really the message, that every religion has its own internal diversity, its own internal resources, has to have the freedom to develop that, and that's where we should be going forward. Feminisms within different religious traditions also, as we know in Christianity, can look very different. You know, some are very traditional and some are very progressive, and they often clash with each other more than they clash with feminisms across religious traditions. Yeah, so there are certain types of critical discourses that are much more similar across religious traditions than within religious traditions. You know, so you have fundamentalist Christian women and fundamentalist Muslim women who operate, who have the same kind of hermeneutic in their tradition and that are very different from more liberal discourses across religious traditions, I would say. So finally, what might women have to contribute to interreligious dialogue that might be distinctive? So here we're talking about the dialogue in general. So the question is there a distinctive contribution of women to interreligious dialogue? Very big question, of course, and one that nobody would put their foot down and say yes or no about. In fact, there was more willingness to say that women have nothing distinctive to contribute than there is to say that women do have something distinctive to contribute. I mean, most of the papers talked about ways in which women have been engaged in interreligious dialogue in a much more holistic way, you know. So some of the papers talked about women during the Second World War who were Christian women active in freeing Jewish men and women from extermination and so forth. So there have been all kinds of ways in which women, in an unseen and unnoticed and unsystematic way, have been involved in interreligious dialogue. There's an article about an interreligious dialogue group in Philadelphia where women, instead of, you know, coming together and discussing big ideas, they just come together and celebrate each other's holidays with each other and then start sharing stories about their faith and come to know each other in a much more, you know, existential way by not just discussing or arguing about beliefs, but by sharing each other's rituals. You know, there are also stories of how women often implicitly have to negotiate different religious identities because they are, you know, married to somebody from a different religion, but they come from, you know, they're still part of their original family and so forth. So their religious identities with some women are also much more fluid. Not that that's anything unique to women. But if there was anything distinctive, it was really more in the direction of women approach dialogue in a much more holistic way. So dialogue is not just a cerebral matter, but is also a matter of the senses. You know, it's also a matter of participating in rituals and aesthetic appreciation and all kinds of dimensions that are not often obvious in interreligious dialogue. But I don't know if you know the name Rita Gross. She's a famous Buddhist feminist. And she was really adamant that women have nothing distinctive to contribute to interreligious dialogue. Now, I mean, I think we have to understand where she comes from also. You know, she comes from a Buddhist tradition that argues against the very existence of any essences or self, continuous and abiding selves and so on. So from within her philosophical background, that would be obvious. On the other hand, you know, she really emphasizes that women just still have to be present at the dialogue table and have to just have their voices heard, no matter what they say or whether or not they have anything distinctive to contribute, just so that they can be present and maybe form a counterbalance to the often, you know, patriarchal discourse that is still often going on in interreligious dialogue. Janine Hill Fletcher has an article focusing on the kinds of topics that are also often used for interreligious dialogue, where male leaders from different religions come together and argue for the, you know, the holiness of the traditional form of marriage and whatnot. So all kinds of topics that might be of particular interest to sort of the male hierarchy in traditions. If women are at the dialogue table, they at least can form a kind of critical reflection or a check on those kinds of things, and then contribute whatever they feel, you know, they can contribute, but without necessarily essentializing women's contribution. So these are a few things I wanted to lay out. I can maybe just, I have a few quotes from the volume that we can look at. So Rosemary Ruther's, "Today, plurality of feminisms has become present in cultures and societies around the world. Feminisms not only have distinct perspectives across these nations, but are in internal conflicts within nations. In India, for example, right-wing Hindu women may appropriate militant feminist language in ways that vilify Indian Muslims, including Indian Muslim women." I just put these quotes up, you know, for us to possibly discuss afterwards. Next one, Aisha. "It is in part due to this association with feminism that some Muslim women scholars may be reticent to engage in interfaith feminist conversations that do not account for feminism's violent colonial history in the Muslim world. Such discussions take for granted the benefits of feminism to religious communities, alienating Muslim women scholars with a different experience of feminism, not to mention perhaps further diminishing their credibility with Muslim audiences." Angela Wong is from Hong Kong. "There is this limitation in the expression interreligious dialogue, as it anticipates and reinforces boundaries as much as it intends to break them down. Alternately, if people are embedded within many layers of culture and identities, the space of inter-in dialogue may focus on the in-betweenness of traditions, which is not so much a tradition of either or, but of both and." Michelle Vos Roberts is... she's a scholar of Hinduism. "The holistic and experiential emphases of feminist theology have contributed to the expansion of interreligious dialogue beyond doctrine and ethics. A broad spectrum of interfaith encounters awakens the senses, from the fascination of unfamiliar rituals or beautiful religious art to participation in transreligious practices such as meditation, yoga, or service." And then finally, Rita Gross. "My skepticism about essences fuels my claim that there is no specifically feminist or women's perspective on issues of religious diversity and the practice of interreligious dialogue. Or perhaps the only specifically feminist position is that women should be at the dialogue table, because otherwise religions are once again demonstrating their historical patriarchy rather than their universal human relevance." And, you know, so this was the fifth in a series of conversations where, you know, scholars from different religious traditions had gathered in Dover to discuss these all kinds of different questions, and in spite of the refusal to say that there was anything distinctive about women's dialogue, that dialogue was totally different, or that conference was totally different from the four that had gone before it. It was really, really remarkable, you know. And I, again, at the danger of essentializing, but it was really interesting how each paper and each presenter tried to find something, and I didn't tell them to do this, but they tried to find something in the previous paper on which they could build. And then the next one built on the previous one, and there was this incredibly constructive, sort of generous kind of atmosphere, whereas, you know, the previous dialogues, most of which were also brilliant, but there was something more combative and, you know, people sort of arguing against the other. And here it was always sort of trying to embrace the other and building upon it. You know, I know this sounds terribly essentializing, but it was just the case, you know. And everyone noticed it, you know. The people who had been at all five dialogues, really it struck everyone that this was really a different way of engaging in conversation with each other. So I just want to... mention that by way of last, you know, comment about women and dialogue. So, but I'd really love to hear what you have to say or think about this.
Thank you very much.